Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. As always, I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 191, I have the pleasure of being rejoined by Dr. Maria Barakal. She and I discussed the Envision Summit, the second annual meeting to be held in Puerto Rico in the spring, as well as diabetic vitrectomy, an update on the discussion we had last time. A list of financial disclosures will be attached in the episode description. In addition, remember that you can claim CME credits for this episode and other select episodes on the AAO website. Just click on the link in the episode description to follow the instructions. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now privileged to be rejoined by Dr. Maria Barakal. She is Director of Barakal & Associates in San Juan, Puerto Rico, a well-known expert, retinal surgeon, doctor, and leader in our field, and she's with me now. Dr. Barakal, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jay.
So we've had you on before, but we're going to hit a couple of big things I wanted to talk to you about. Last time you were on, we were in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, and you can talk a little about this, but Puerto Rico is still recovering from that terrible storm 2 years later. And now, we're recording this September 9th, 2019. We're a week removed from the Bahamas just getting absolutely shattered by Hurricane Dorian. And one of the things I wanted to encourage listeners to do, and you can reference having been on Ground Zero in Puerto Rico, how important it is for people to help and send aid and really kind of to do what they can to support the Bahamas in this time.
Well, yes. The problem with the hurricane is that they're so unpredictable. And you have, the casualties and the damage at the beginning, a lot of like infrastructure. There is usually no water, no food. Which is, the immediate things. Healthcare becomes a problem because most hospitals are destroyed and whatnot. There's no electricity. But then, further on, the problems change. A lot of the businesses close because they can't really survive for a prolonged period of time without electricity. So a lot of, the motor that drives the economy in islands usually gets severely damaged or destroyed altogether. So long term, the recovery is very gradual. You have to rebuild houses, rebuild structures, then try to, have more the economy moving. And that is pretty much where Puerto Rico is, because a lot of areas were without electricity for up to a year. So a lot of people, we had a big exodus of population, usually the working class, younger people with children whose schools were closed. They all moved to the mainland and have remained there. So basically, a young people drain has occurred. The Bahamas is really tragic because a lot of the structures were wooden and nothing is really left. So the death toll will continue to rise. At the beginning, it's very hard to assess the death toll, which happened here, because it's not only the direct deaths from, the water and the surge and the wind and, all that, but it's the secondary deaths that occur because you're ill and you do not have a ventilator or you cannot get to your dialysis center, so you die because of that. Or you don't have any, you can't access any health services. So I think the Bahamas really is in dire need. I think what Jose Andres is doing, which he did in Puerto Rico, he's feeding 10,000 people in the Bahamas, and he preemptively went to Nassau to orchestrate that, is really wonderful. And it is really a lifesaver, just preparing all those meals and just taking them by helicopter over to the ravaged areas. But the recovery there will be very, very, very slow. People are just leaving because there's nothing, there's nowhere to sleep, there's nothing to eat, there's no water. So it's a really very, very sad situation.
It's interesting. You referenced Jose Andres, and I think there's different ways people who are listening can give back if you haven't already. I mean, American Red Cross is taking donations, but World Central Kitchen, with Jose Andres, is obviously taking donations to help fund that effort to to bring meals, and you said Royal Caribbean has brought meals, and it kind of tells you how everything in life is kind of a game of inches, you know, because that hurricane was off the coast of South Florida for 2-3 days. If it turns one way, like you said, they're unpredictable, then maybe right now we're not having this conversation and I'm sitting in the dark, and more importantly, there are a lot of people and having lots of issues here, and it's bad, you know. It's the best case scenario was it not touching anything, and it's, you know, people here, I think, we almost feel this guilt here in South Florida because I think people were happy that it didn't come, and then they saw what happened to the Bahamas and just felt horrible. And Puerto Rico also, you know, just going through Maria 2 years ago, Dorian came very close to going through Puerto Rico again. And mm-hmm. all it takes is a little move here, a little move there. We're having a completely different conversation, or again, not even having this conversation. So it like you said, it's really important for the support to be there. It's going to take time. And I was going to save that for the end of this conversation, but I think that in order of importance, it's probably the most important thing to talk about right now. So I just wanted to lead off with that. And again, anyone who's listening, there's definitely big ways to help. You know, to transition, Puerto Rico, like you said, has been rebuilding, recovering. And one of the big things you helped start was this meeting last year in Puerto Rico, which is the Envision meeting. You want to tell our listeners a little bit about Envision and what it set out to do and what you guys are doing in the future?
Well, actually, Envision was Bonnie Henderson's idea. And it was a fantastic idea because she wanted to make to have a different meeting, very different to all the other meetings that we normally go to, which, you know, you're in lectures all day. There's very little interaction. Most of the speakers tend to be men, and you have to take a lot of time out of your work schedule to do so. So she wanted, she had an idea of having a meeting that would be different, that would be very family friendly, that it would be engaging with the community, giving back to whichever communities they chose to be at, to have the meeting at. And lucky for us, actually, Bonnie wanted to do it in Puerto Rico to help in their recovery. And last year, it was in Tiamat, one of the resorts that that was open, that was not damaged too much. And it was actually a wonderful meeting. The meeting, most of the idea of the meeting is really to empower women to have leadership positions in meetings and to be at the podium and to network in ways that have traditionally been done by men. Because if you go to any meeting, particularly in Retina, you would see that most of the speakers, a very large proportion, are men. There's some women, and that has been changing maybe in the last decade, but traditionally that has not been the case. And this is a meeting that is, there's a plane going by, sorry about that. But this is a meeting where the idea is to be multi-specialty so that you can get the state-of-the-art information about what's going on in all fields. It has a lot of, like, roundtable discussions, a lot of time for questions, a lot of time for networking. And it has some really innovative topics. For example, how to make it to the podium, how to interact with industry if you want to participate in industry, how to invest your money, how to work with the FDA. You know, a lot of things that nobody really talks about in traditional meetings, those topics will be covered. How to be involved in world ophthalmology. A lot of things that are of interest. Also, it has a give back activity where children are welcome and family members. Last year, we did a screening in an area that has a very high incidence of diabetes in the island, and it's a very poor area. And we did it in the Ricky Martin Foundation. And we screened, you know, a significant number of diabetic patients, and we found patients that had never seen anybody who had proliferative disease. So it was actually a very worthwhile activity, and the children went to. So all in all, I think it is really a unique meeting in that sense, that you can really learn other aspects of what how to read a contract, how to change practices, a lot of things that nobody really talks about, but that really affect all of us throughout our careers at different stages. And it is done during President's Day weekend, which is really wonderful because you don't really lose a lot of time from your practices. And usually most families have vacations, so people can come with their families or without. It's going to be in the Carib Hilton in San Juan, which is a wonderful location because it's right between Condado, the tourist area, and Old San Juan. It has its own private beach, and it has just been recently remodeled, and it looks great. So I think everybody will have a wonderful time.
And just before we move on, you know, I was looking on the website, and it seems, again, you're very open to presentations and ideas and people who want to be involved. So any sort of particular topics that are more interesting, or if someone's listening, they're like, oh, I want to speak, what sort of things are you looking for?
Well, whoever wants to speak, they can speak about their area of interest within ophthalmology, because there's cornea sections, refractive, plastics. There's going to be the plastic session. It's actually with one of the best injectors of the East Coast, which happens to be in Puerto Rico, Dr. Montes. And it's like a live type of thing. But whoever wants to participate just has to email any of the people in the organizing committee or Bonnie and just say, look, I really want to participate. And, you know, they will be, we will try to include as many people as we can. And this is the whole idea of the meeting, and also to make a database of people who are interested, women who are interested in particular, to speak at meetings and to be more proactive and to participate more. Because oftentimes, you know, there may be a lot of women out there who are very accomplished, fantastic speakers, but, you know, people who are organizing meetings may not know about them. So I think having a database and having people communicate, you know, their wishes and what they want to participate in will be very useful for everyone.
Well, last thing we're going to talk about, and I'm going to spend a few minutes now just picking your brain, because there's nobody better to ask about diabetic vitrectomy that I can think of. And I'm going to reference some of my recent cases and some of the challenges. So we've already talked about, and we've talked at length, that there's a lot of people, including yourself, who have really advocated that early vitrectomy may be beneficial for patients with proliferative diabetic retinopathy. Every scenario is a little different. But my question for you, and this is the million-dollar question, is certain things that during the actual procedure. So I'll give you examples of things, and maybe, again, we only remember our failures because they're more painful, and we don't remember all the other successes that we just take for granted. But one of the things I find that's challenging is, and I've seen this in a couple of patients, is rebleed, right? And so one of the more common complications of diabetic vitrectomy, whether it's for vitreous hemorrhage or tractional detachment, is a rebleed. I find in my experience, it tends to happen more often in my phakic patients, not often, but when it happens, it's been phakic men. And I found that when I go back in and they've required washout, and I've gone back in and washed them out, I usually do combine it with the phaco at that point, and everything looks anatomically good when I get back there, and there's no recurrent detachment. I feel like I did a very good job with the laser and everything else, the first procedure. But then the visual acuity in those cases just isn't what I would have expected or wanted, and the patient never really recovers. And if I do an angiogram, there seems to be a component of macular ischemia. And I haven't found the literature, Dr. Barakal, and maybe this is something other people observe, maybe they have not, but I can't understand if it's that these are patients with more fragile circulation who are more prone to rebleeding, or we've always thought of vitreous hemorrhage as kind of an innocuous complication, but maybe the vitreous hemorrhage and subsequent stress of another procedure predisposes these fragile patients to macular ischemia. But post-operative macular ischemia is something I really struggle with, because I feel like the ways we know how to reduce it are, you know, reduce your operative time, keep the pressure low, things like that. But we do have to elevate the pressure to get hemostasis to prevent rebleeding. So just speaking from your experience, we have a lot of fellows, young attendings listening. How do you kind of navigate that balance? Because I feel like some of these become can't-win situations where, yes, you managed to stabilize the retina, but the vision in the end wasn't what you wanted or what the patient wanted.
Well, I That is one thing that we contend with, and the reason why we see it more in phakic eyes is because pseudophakic eyes, you usually can get part of the blood clearing through the, you know, through the sonials or through the posterior capsule. Like one thing that I do, if I have a rebleed in a diabetic that is pseudophakic, I yag the posterior capsule all the way through the sides, you know, so that, yes, that actually, I thought about publishing it and I never did. And then, that's his name, it was published by someone else. But what you do is you dilate it really well, and then you yag, you know, where the two capsules are together and there's no IOL on the edges. You just do like an opening there. I usually do one or two. And usually that is enough to have clearing because that just makes a conduit of the blood in the posterior chamber to the anterior chamber. And usually that works. For phakic eyes, actually, I do not take them back to the OR. Very rarely do I do that. What I do is I do an air fluid exchange in the office. I have been doing this forever. And whoever wants, I can send them a video. I'm going to send it as one of the procedures to one of the journals with the video attached so that people can see exactly how it's done. But usually, I would say that out of every like 10 rebleeds, I only had to take back to the OR, maybe one. And what you do, it's a very simple procedure. It takes like 3 minutes. You basically take a 10cc syringe, fill it with 5cc of filtered air, position the patient sideways, and position the syringe with a 27-gauge needle perpendicular to the floor. And you basically sequentially, through the pars plana, with a speculum in the eye, aspirate and inject until you fill the syringe with about 4cc of the fluid in the eye, which is usually serosanguinous. And you replace that with air, and that usually clears most hemorrhages. Because usually you don't find the bleeder, because what tends to bleed are some of the epicenters that we cut. So what I do in cases where I worry about this, I tend to put a Avastin at the end of the case to try and prevent rebleeding. The other thing that causes, you know, the main cause of rebleeding is usually hypotony in the first day after surgery, which tends to happen more with sutureless vitrectomy, particularly when you're using, you know, higher gauges, you know, larger incisions. So I think it happens more with 23 than with 25, and happens more with 25 than with 27. With 27, it happens way less, just because those wounds seal a lot better. You know, with movements of the eye, even though we may not have a leak by the time we end the surgery, with the patient, you know, pressing the lids and whatnot, you can get hypotony in that day. You know, the paper that Ali Khan published comparing 27-gauge and to, you know, the chances of rebleeding in the perioperative period were way lower than what we normally see in other gauges. So I think that is another reason why using 27 may be advantageous. Why do we get increased ischemia in the fovea? I think it's very hard to tell, you know, what exactly causes it. Obviously, pressure can do it. These eyes may have very fragile circulation. Sometimes we don't really know if they have a vitreous hemorrhage or a traction detachment, how ischemic they are to begin with, you know, because we can't exactly see back there. So, you know, what I would say is that I usually try to, if I raise the pressure, which sometimes you have to cause, you know, I raise it maybe to 60, and as soon as I see that it stops bleeding, I start lowering, you know, sequentially as quickly as I can, and then I just laser whatever bleeders are bleeding. I like using the laser better than the diathermy, just because it's you know, more efficient. And I usually, in all the cases where I do that I do for vitreous hemorrhage or traction detachment, I leave air at the end. That way I can see there's like bleeding areas. So I always do like an air fluid exchange at the end.
Perfect. Well, you know, one of the things that happened, those are all great thoughts. I love the YAG idea, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. One of the things that happens is then you start overcorrecting and doing things differently. You know, so one of the things I've started doing, especially because many of my diabetic patients are working and it's hard for them to take time off and they have some degree of cataract, is I'll take them for a combined cataract procedure and vitrectomy. And not everyone has that luxury depending on their practice setting, but I'm able to do that for some of these people. And so I'll take them to the cataract. I'll open the capsule at that time unless I get to the back and I think there's significant need for tamponade and I'm concerned about, you know, gas or oil coming forward. If I'm thinking we're just going to put, you know, fluid or air, then I'll open the capsule, which in, if there is some blood, it can clear faster, and do a very, very thorough anterior vitrectomy as well. And the rebleeds go down. What does increase is inflammation postoperatively. And I've run into that. I think it's a combination of the cataract surgery. It's a combination of laser to the retina and then just the surgical time. And diabetics do tend to have an abnormal blood aqueous barrier and they spill. And these patients get significant inflammation. And so my correction for that was use some sort of steroid, perioperative, periocular, or intravitreal. And it does help. But I still have had a couple of patients with pretty significant inflammation. And I recently had a patient who not only had no breaks at the time of the original surgery, but looked great for 2 months and then subsequently developed this kind of inflammatory response postoperatively that seemed improving and then subsequently developed a tractional detachment related to that. And so my question, Maria, this is a roundabout way to get into this, is how much laser do you think you need to do in these eyes where you go in, you do a very thorough vitrectomy, you've stained multiple times, you make sure the hyaloid is up. How much peripheral endolaser do you need?
Well, those are very good questions, and I have some comments about what you're saying. As far as the laser, I don't really do very aggressive laser. I usually treat the periphery all the way to the aura because that is easy to do in the OR and not that easy to do because it's painful and whatnot in the office. So I usually treat from the equator to the periphery. And then if I see areas that where I see ischemia or if I have an angiogram, it was a traction detachment, I may treat a little closer. But I do not go all the way to the arcades. I think less is more. You can always add more later. As far as the inflammation, I do a lot of combined procedures. If they have some cataract, I take the cataract out at the same time that I do a vitrectomy. I have been doing that for years. Many of my patients have really poor insurance, and they can only be operated once. So, you know, I do it both at the same time. And I put intraoperative Kenalog and Septinone's Kenalog both at the end of the procedure. And I think that is really, really, really helpful in curbing inflammation. I did have, and it has happened to me once, I did have one patient who happens to be one of my neighbors that had a traction detachment. It was a very interesting case because I removed the hyaloid. I removed everything. I lasered her. She was doing great. Like 6 months later, she comes in with macular edema. I inject her with Avastin, and she calls me 5 days later that she's seeing a lot less. And she developed this PBRS reaction, which I had really, you know, never seen. But I think we get a lot of that, a lot of inflammation usually tends to occur in patients that have renal disease and very poorly controlled high blood pressure. You know, way back when we started doing lung cases and the like, we would sometimes get this horrible fibrinoid reaction in patients, and it was always the renal and, you know, hypertensive who have, you know, all these who are, you know, very ill. So on those, I tend to be more aggressive. The other thing that I find useful, sometimes, you know, a lot of these patients have partial vitreous detachments, and it's really, really hard to make sure that you remove all of the hyaloid because they have vitrosquesis in areas, you know, you think you're removing a layer and then there's another layer. So I think using triamcinolone intraoperatively to try and visualize everything is useful. But oftentimes, even if you do that, there's the little pockets of like which is left, which I think accounts for the cases where we actually do see like a late traction detachment. What I do when I do combined cases, besides opening on the back, if I'm not going to use oil or anything, I do what I'm talking about. I extend it towards the periphery, and I make sure that the openings through and through, posterior and anterior capsule, and that way, if you get a rebleed, they clear super fast.
That's great. And I like how you referenced the fibrinoid reaction, because that was something I never saw as a fellow and never even learned about. It's a lot of retina is kind of passed down. You read textbooks. But then I had a patient who ended up being a dialysis patient. You referenced renal disease, who had mm-hmm. travel demands and did a phaco vitrectomy, did some laser, gave him some steroid, and he still got a fibrinoid reaction. I remember post-op day one looking yeah. inside, and it was like, his eye is white and quiet. He doesn't have an hypopyon. He's a little bit of cell. He does all this fibrin in the vitreous. And I remember, you know, racking my brain and looking it up, and I ran into Dr. Harry Flynn, and I was like, you know, I have this guy who has this reaction. And he was like, oh, that's the fibrinoid reaction. He's like, we used to see that all the time. And then mm-hmm. I went back, and all the papers that were published in are older. And it became one of those things that was published, and then people knew about it. And then, you know, it's one of those things that gets lost in the literature because you just don't see it as much.
I think we see it less because, remember, way back when we used to see it a lot, people were doing extra caps in these patients, and we were doing 20 gauge, you know, with really big incisions. So, and cases would take way longer. Now, you know, we have the luxury of seeing it much more rarely. I would say that, you know, I see something like that maybe once every couple of years, something like that. We see it a lot less with small gauge. And I think that is really the beauty of small gauge.
My last question for you is, one of the things I never trained to do, but then I had some patients with recurrent proliferation in the macula with epiretinal membrane, was ILM peeling in these eyes. And what I try to teach my fellows is it's all about goals. If you have a very bad tractional combined regmatous detachment, I don't think it's a priority unless you really have time and space to do it, because you have a limited window to operate in these eyes. You don't want to be in these eyes forever, and the view and everything can deteriorate. But in these eyes that you go in to lift the hyaloid, is there value, since you're doing laser and they can get epiretinal membrane and peeling the ILM? I didn't start doing it. Then again, you react. You have patients with bad ERM proliferation. You have to go back in. I've started doing it in some eyes, and I've been a little just disappointed with the results. Again, this is all anecdotal, but I do think it prevents ERM. I still have patients who will proliferate around the edge of the ILM peel. So if I peel the arcade, they'll still proliferate along the arcade wherever I stopped peeling. I don't think that's an argument to keep peeling beyond, though I know there's people who advocate for that. I think there's disadvantages to that from just surgical time, trauma, hemostasis, things we've talked about. And then I've had some patients who've developed unexpected thinning of the retina, and the vision just, again, it's not bad, but it's just not as good as you'd like. What are your thoughts on ILM peeling in these diabetic eyes? Because I'm starting to think that, go back and think maybe they're so fragile, it may not be the best idea. People have advocated like for ERM peeling, not to peel ILM, and that's something that's controversial. But I feel like these eyes, the retina is even more fragile. Maybe that extra manipulation isn't a good idea.
Yes, I agree with you completely. I do not peel the ILM. I think these retinas are, you either have two things. Either you have ischemic retinas or you have swollen retinas with some edema. And when you peel the ILM, you can convert, you know, a cyst into a full thickness macular hole. Or you can, you know, you can really, I think you damage the retina. The ILM is there for a reason. It's not like it's an abnormal tissue. And, you know, if the hyaloid is attached and you're detaching the hyaloid, you're not going to have any epiretinal membrane there to begin with. So I definitely, those eyes, I just don't touch, you know, the ILM. If it is a case that has, you know, an epiretinal membrane or by OCT, I see maybe, you know, some tissue there, then I may peel the tissue, but I don't go after the ILM. You know, who was it? I think it was Stanley who published worse results in epiretinal membranes when the ILM was peeled than when it wasn't, worse visual results. And this is a normalized. So I think probably diabetic eyes are even more vulnerable. Sure, you get less of a recurrence of epiretinal membrane, but I don't see that as such a huge problem in these diabetic eyes that I think it warrants the risk of removing the ILM and all of the trauma. The other thing that we rarely talk about, but it is a reality, is like every time that we're removing the ILM, particularly if we're doing using forceps or whatever we're using really to lift the edge or to lift it, we're really damaging the RPE. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the incidence of actually iatrogenic choroidal neovascularization in many of these eyes is not innocuous. We published a series of those eyes, my group Pacores, and I have seen it, you know, in my practice in some eyes. So I think, you know, there's a lot of, we damage more than we think by doing that. So in these very fragile eyes, I think less is more.
Yeah, and my last question for you is, let's say you don't peel ILM and they do get a recurrent ERM. Do you peel the ILM then? Or again, do you feel like if they're fragile, just peel the ERM and get in and get out?
I just peel the ERM. I think when you know, we tried this years ago and we published it too, which is, you know, trying to predict, you know, ILM, how much was left after peeling the epiretinal membrane. And usually in these very adherent epiretinal membranes, when you remove them, you remove the ILM too, at least in that area. We restained it and did this, you know, in the OR to check for that. So I'm not really, unless I see, if I remove the epiretinal membrane and I still see like a lot of stria that I think maybe the ILM is thickened. I do not have intraoperative OCT. If I had intraoperative OCT, I think it would be very worthwhile because then you could see, you know, if the ILM looks particularly thick or corrugated in certain areas. And then, you know, that would be a reason to peel it. I don't have, you know, intraoperative OCT, but if it looks still, you know, with a lot of stria, I may stain, you know, with brilliant blue, and then if it looks funny to me, then I may peel it. But I tend to be very conservative on that.
Dr. Bearcall, I could talk about diabetic retractor or anything with you for hours, but I appreciate your time. I know you're very busy. And again, our listeners appreciate hearing from you and looking forward to seeing you at Academy soon.
Yes, thank you, Jay. It's always a pleasure to do this. I love your podcast, by the way. I listen to all of them.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all other episodes on our website. All 191 episodes, including this one, can be found. They're posted in category and sorted for you. You can also read our blog, Equal Friend Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils, up on the website. To contact us, you can click on the Contact Us button on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at retinapodcast. We love feedback. Feedback helps us know what we're doing well and what we can do better in the future. And we appreciate everyone who's left positive reviews in the Apple and Android stores. Many thanks to Dr. Maria Bearcall for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Benicasa for preparing this episode. Maria Bearcall and I spoke a little bit about hurricane relief efforts in the Bahamas. Anyone who's listening who wants to give back, I really encourage you. There's multiple ways to give back. American Red Cross, as well as the World Central Kitchen, are taking donations. So whatever you can do, again, Bahamas is just a jump across the pond for us. A lot of close friends, patients, and colleagues with family there or who are there. So please, anything we can do to help would be greatly appreciated and can make a huge impact. Thank you again for everything you do, the patients you see and take care of, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.